looking for clues, looking for details that might give you some sort of like realization or epiphany.
It can be a good thing. Like, it doesn't have to be this really sad, tragic struggle.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Samantha Groth. We've got a feature episode for you this week, made by one of our Melbourne producers, Angela Glinderman. But she wants you to call her Ange, and that matters, because there's power in a name. It's how we really know who we are, right? A warning that there's strong language and discussion of slurs coming up.
Hey, I'm Angela, but I prefer Ange. When I'm called Angela, it reminds me of getting told off as a child. I feel a little apologetic. Maybe even a little defensive. So call me Ange, unless you're mad at me. I'm also queer. I like this word. I like the way that it's evolved from meaning something odd or strange, how it's been reclaimed in a positive light. To me, there's a sense of power in taking this word as a label, so I do. Names and words in general can carry so much power.
Queer to us felt like a welcoming term.
He or she, I feel, is just more succinct.
The thing about queer for me is that it's liberation, like, in word form.
Recent experience has also lent a new weight to two very simple words, yes and no.
The Australians have spoken and they have shouted yes.
The No campaign has been going about its task very purposefully in pointing out the consequences if we were to change the definition of marriage.
We've been lifted by support from the local cafes with vote yes signs in the windows. My daughter always tried to count them. How many yes signs do we see today?
It's a weird time, and words can seem particularly potent. One of the categories of words that can be particularly defining are labels.
As far as I'm concerned, I don't take offence at anything I'm called.
I gone with bi because that was, I chose it, I guess, at the time. I'd only, like, it kind of referenced a lot from what I was like as a teen, so just having crushes on girls and boys. Like, I'm not even sure that the word encompasses all of that. It's just, it's a reference point, I suppose.
It was nice to have a really specific label. I think it's kind of a luxury to have a label that people, like, biphobia aside, that people know what it means.
Finding a label can be empowering. To take something indefinable, something out of reach, and give it a name to make it real. Sometimes a label is just a shortcut, a bargain made with a language that fails to capture something fundamental. This linguistic compromise saves some awkwardness, or it serves a practical purpose. It's complicated. Midsummer is a queer arts festival that happens in Melbourne every summer. It's a bit like Mardi Gras, a big public celebration of queerness, with events all around the city. Hares and Hyenas is a queer and alternative bookshop, and they host events all year round. So when it's midsummer time, they've got a busy roster of spoken word and other performances. It was so refreshing to be in a welcoming space where I just felt like I was part of a community. No one was heckling or judging, and it was just a safe space for expression. So I wanted to talk to some of the crowd about how they express themselves.
My preferred label would probably be queer, gay or lesbian, one of those three. I'm not super fussed about it.
My relationship with labels has kind of changed. Initially, I liked the word bi because it was all encompassing and I felt it respected my past and all that. But then there was the politics around it of it versus pan, which can mean the same thing or can mean different. And, you know, then I was like, well, can I be both? So I think I find labels honestly frustrating.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of power held in labels. And I think there is a lot of privilege in not being able to feel the need to use labels. And I guess I still spend a lot of time reconciling what that means for me.
I don't really think about it. I never think, oh, I'm a gay man. Because I hang out more in the straight scene, so I just don't think about that sort of stuff.
And maybe we don't even need labels.
because as soon as we qualify something, it becomes, you know, like part of a system, and I don't like that.
There's a limit on labels. I'm not going to spell out to you what you can and can't do. I expect you to intuit that.
I don't have a label. I don't... just anything positive.
No word means the same thing to two people. When we say a word, we create a space, a changeable space, into which flows experiences, memories, ideas, identities. And between these words, so much is left unspoken. Sometimes new words appear in these spaces. In my interviews, the word that got mentioned the most was queer. My history of that word began with Garbage's 1995 song, Queer. This was the first time I heard the word, and I really just thought it meant strange or odd. It was just a cool word that sounded jarring and unusual and sort of a bit off, but in this really appealing way, sort of like the song itself. But then I learned more about queer. It could also mean someone who wasn't straight or wasn't cis or was otherwise existing outside of these binaries. So years later, I found new power in taking the queer label for myself. But is that how everyone else feels?
I think that queer is a nice label to sort of extend beyond that as a thing, where it's not gender essentialist or sexuality essentialist. It's about, you know, being attracted to people.
I used it though with some like older gay gentlemen, and they were like, it wasn't cool because like from that age group, it was seen as like quite a derogatory term. And I was like, oh, I'm really sorry. I like that word.
As I started talking to other people in the LGBTIQA community, I realised that everyone has a different point of view on this one word, and that the main thing that we had in common was that many of us had thought about it.
The thing about queer for me is that it's liberation, like, in word form. The very word itself, you know, weird, odd, left of centre, going against the grain. Queer encapsulates what I'm about, and it seems to encompass sexual attraction, gender performance, or just, like, general lifestyle. Queer for me is as much a verb as it is a noun and an adjective. Queering is always processual. It's always in process.
I do like queer, and I do like queer as a term, and I think it gives young people who haven't quite figured out exactly how they identify yet a safe place. I think it's nice for a kid who hasn't quite worked out, you know, exactly who they're attracted to yet to be able to say I'm queer rather than being I'm gay. Oh, wait, no, I still... like these people as well, so I guess I'm not quite. And so you can sort of have that little nice family room to hang out in while you're working out exactly how you identify, which I think is nice.
Queer in itself, I think, has been sort of co-opted into an aesthetic, an identity, a politic, and is in itself kind of elitist.
The groups that I'm part of, they're pretty intergenerational. And there's a bit of a generational divide around language sometimes, which I've noticed most around the word queer. And I can definitely understand, like, as it was historically used as a slur against us and actually still is in, you know, in a few places. And I think I've heard maybe more so in regional areas still.
Queer to us felt like a welcoming term, and also snubbed your nose to everyone who said queer was a bad word. So it was a good word for us, because before that we were punks.
Something I heard in my discussion about labels stood out as a way to cope.
Intent's very important, but so is how it's received, and I think that's probably something people need to be a lot more aware of.
What feels good as a label for me might not feel good for someone else. After all, I've encountered this in other ways too. I know that there are many female-identifying people who love to call their platonic friends girlfriends. To them, maybe that word feels playful, or because they only date cis men, it identifies these friendships as platonic ones. But to me, I feel erased when someone uses it. When I want to tell someone about my sexuality in a subtle way, sometimes I just mention my girlfriend in conversation. But sometimes it doesn't work because people assume I'm talking about a platonic girlfriend. It's the way that language can kind of hide what I am, and it feels like a sort of power is being taken from me because I can't express myself. Around the same time I started having these conversations, I'd been searching for ways of understanding myself, and I'd turned to the arts. I'll admit to watching Carol more times than I can count. It felt good to be seen, to have my identity confirmed in words. It felt sort of like I was being told that everything would be okay, and that there were people out there who knew how I was feeling, even if I'd never met them.
I still think of how this road was made for us. The sun is different here, where our love like a talisman ward off the lines I wrote to demarcate you from me. They aren't incarnations to summon you. I don't think this means I really want you back. In my life, I'm happiest when I'm moving away from shards of geography. This us is genealogy leaving imprints in the shade.
That was an excerpt from Motion by Adolfo Aranjuez. It was published in Cordite Poetry Review in their Queer issue. Adolfo writes and performs, and he edits Metro, a film magazine, as well as being editor-in-chief of Archer, a magazine about sexuality, gender, and identity.
I am first and foremost a writer and editor, so words are my life. Of course, language evolves and grows to match changes in our politics in our communities, but sometimes our terms and syntaxes and grammars don't keep up quickly enough with the changes in our lived realities.
Adolfo found that his understanding of queerness grew through an editorial struggle with the singular they pronoun.
If an agent is singular, then our options are he and she, no questions. But then I realized as I immersed myself more within the queer community and met more people that that was an enormously fucked way to think. There are actual humans being impacted, being hurt by the continual reference to the binary formulation he or she. Their lived realities are not he or she, so what kind of terrible custodian of language was I that I was prohibiting the language from serving them, from validating them? There's power in naming. As much as language can be wielded for ostracization, I guess it's also a vehicle for opening up, for opining, for opportunity. That's a beautiful thing.
It came about after a trip that I had with a friend of mine where we got really, really drunk at a bar in Prague and decided that we needed to start a positive queer zine.
Catherine Back is the co-editor of Concrete Queers, an LGBTIQA zine. She's also keen on seeing more queer experiences put into words.
It sort of came from that idea that, like, there's this really negative portrayal of queerness in the media. Everything's a struggle story, everything's a coming out story, and you can't just have, like, a couple of really happy lesbians running around in space shooting monsters kind of thing. And we wanted to have more of that. We wanted to have, especially for young kids who are sort of coming to terms with who they are, giving them the idea that it can be a good thing. Like, it doesn't have to be this really sad, tragic struggle.
Catherine's been around for 10 editions of Concrete Queers, so she's heard a lot of stories. I asked her which stories stuck in her mind the most. She told me about Young Spells, an interactive story by Tegan Elizabeth Webb.
About her as a kid, as a young kid, sort of coming to terms with her sexuality, but also doing witchy stuff, like making spells and all this kind of stuff. And there was just a few moments in that where she's just, you know, collecting feathers and stuff, but also realizing she has a crush on her friend that just really hit home really, really hard. And I think that was probably the most I've had a piece resonate with me. And it was just this random, like, fun little game that she'd made that just really hit home. And I think it's always the stuff you don't expect.
I played through the interactive story a couple of times and found myself relating to it too.
I'm pretty sure that means you're bi, which is different, but still totally legit. It's not like there's a gay card or a gay scale or anything. It should only be one word, so it's easy to write on our pencil cases and scratch it on the back of toilet doors at school. I uncap the Sharpie and write it out in big, thick capital letters. Gabrielle. Fuck yeah, Izzy says, admiring her new Sharpie tattoo. Now give me your arm, I'll write it on you.
Tegan told me writing Young Spells was just like forming an identity.
You're going back through or forward through these memories, kind of almost like mining, like looking for clues, looking for details, looking for little bits and pieces that might give you some sort of like realization or epiphany. And that's kind of how I feel about like when I'm writing about myself.
Tegan's characters were on a similar journey.
Wanting it to be non-linear was, I think, important to me because, and also to, but like not have like a definitive end for you to be going back and playing it again and again, I guess relates back to what I was saying before about like constantly going back and like examining yourself, looking at yourself and kind of, you know, piecing together who you are as a person.
And there's also a lot of freedom to choose different words in the story. There are clickable words called cycling links that change rather than taking you to a new plot point. Blue can become green and he can become she.
I really liked using it for that, for those purposes, to kind of help or let players build their own parts within the whole paragraph, I suppose. I started off using the cycling links to show that the character had crushes on different genders, so her own gender and others as well. I wanted to make sure that I took that responsibility for my protagonist's identity.
When I came out, my instinct was to express myself in writing. I had been working on a rather romantic story, and it just kept falling flat. But when I changed the gender of the love interest, all of a sudden, it just came to life. Just changing that one word from he to she made all the difference. I wondered if it might make a difference to future readers too, who could see themselves reflected in a story. On some level, it had been an unconscious choice. I was just expressing myself to myself. But hopefully, by putting that kind of experience in words on paper, I can also reach out to others, and hopefully they can relate.
I say I'm easygoing with it, and I am. But I'm easygoing, born out of the frustration that I, in this lifetime, probably won't ever be recognised for what I identify as, because it's a grey area. So I'm not trans and I'm not cis. I am kind of both and neither, but for me personally, for me, I'm not super into the singular they for me. He or she, I feel, is just more succinct because I'm a writer. So because I'm a writer and my gender presentation is never going to be normalised or understood, I'm like, look, I might as well get the ones that sound the best.
Lisa Skye, a writer and performer, has been curating a spoken word event at Midsummer, the Queer Arts Festival, for 10 years.
So many of my acts now, you know, I've been on this whole journey with them and, you know, from them being a very emerging newbie artist to an established, like, elder statesman. And sometimes they'll just make me cry.
She mentioned one particular performer who had read the same poem at the event in different years.
The first time they read it, it was very vulnerable, very submissive, very I'm laying myself out for you. And then a couple of years later, as both of our identities kind of morphed in and changed in the same way, the poem that they read, the same one, was really a kind of like super dominant, like, go on, do this. And just the absolute tonal shift was, you know, because it reflected in their identity. It was such a privilege and a joy to watch. And, yeah, that's why I do this.
I went to Lisa Skye's show, but I didn't have permission to record it because she wants the performers to be safe in the knowledge that if they share something vulnerable or an insecurity, this stays in the room. As I sat in the audience, tucked away in Hares and Hyenas, that same bookshop I talked about before, I felt invited to share in the ups and downs of lives that mirrored my own. In a darkened room, it felt safe to have those private emotional responses while feeling reassured that the person next to me was probably feeling the same.
It is intoxicating. It's intoxicating feeling that that kind of, oh, holy crap, me too. And I love when I get off stage and people are just compelled to say, like, yes, my girlfriend and her girlfriend do the exact same thing and, oh, my God, that's so amazing. And it's just this really lovely, like, to be a voice for those people, I mean, yeah, it's just, it's so nice.
Google is your friend. Google is your best friend. You can do so much independent learning now, and I think that that's where we've come in these last few years of being like, okay, I see something that I don't really understand. Instead of asking a question to a person that exists, I can talk to my computer and they can teach me this new thing.
That's Xanthi Dobby, a new media artist and curator. We met up at a conversation event called Queersome Space, which was curated by the Lifted Brow and XYX Lab. Xanthi said that the internet can be a great way of making sure that we're not expecting people who are marginalised to explain things to us, and it can be a great way of understanding ourselves. But online dialogues aren't always so productive.
A few people commented on how the language used, particularly online, is often quite warlike and violent, which is so calling out. And that's definitely something I try to resist. I could definitely see why people use it, because we do have a pretty violent and dark history.
That's Claire O'Hanlon, a volunteer from the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives. They're talking about a midsummer event, Generations of Queer. I spoke to Claire because I was curious about the way that our history comes up in the here and now.
And I think it's particularly important to document our histories and tell our stories in our own words. So that's why it's really important to have community organisations do this, given that they have historically been marginalised and often misrepresented, if represented at all.
It's empowering to know where you come from.
The one key reason I've sort of stayed involved is because I've found some safety and comfort in the archives and among the history. And it was particularly around the postal survey period, needed to retreat from more, like, I guess, political and activist spaces. And I think the digging in the archives and reflecting on and celebrating the past has given me some hope and perspective as well.
When you're telling a story that hasn't been told much, or maybe at all, the words that you choose become such a big deal. Claire told me about the ongoing discussions at the archives about changing their name, from lesbian and gay to encompassing a broader spectrum of identities. They mentioned the words rainbow and pride, but some people felt that these words didn't reflect the activist history that made them so proud. When I asked Claire about the future, their first thought was to create more opportunities for wordplay.
That's the answer. That's the solution. There'll be more puns and more, just more playful. And, like, we do have a history of playing with language.
This space to laugh and be kind to one another was particularly important last year during the postal survey. Suddenly, it seemed that even those two very simple words, yes and no, had taken on all of these new meanings as they became the subject of so much public discussion. But I knew too that I was operating from a position of privilege. I'm in a monogamous relationship, and I'm cisgendered and white and many other categories. For some other people in the LGBTIQA community, they felt that some of the messages in the Yes campaign didn't match their experience. For example, they might not identify with being in a same-sex partnership, or they might not feel connected to the institution of marriage.
I think that the Yes campaign focused very, very heavily on this notion of homonormative, monogamous love, which is, it really undermines all of the work that we've done as queer people to opening up those terms. I exist within a very privileged white body, so I'm granted all sorts of concessions all the time, where people automatically look at me and they're like, okay, you're an educated white woman, I'm just going to trust the things that you say, which is such a problematic idea.
Yeah, I don't know if I felt represented, but then that's like a whole other thing of, like, I had access to marriage before queer people, basically, given the relationship that I was in, like, that was a whole complexity there that I kind of struggled with as well.
I know that there was a lot of use of same-sex marriage rather than marriage equality, which is not necessarily indicative of the issue. Well, there's a lot of issues with sort of equating sex and gender, and especially with the trans issues.
And then I realised, like, oh, hang on, we're not defining the terms in the correct way. You know, I'm defining yes as, all right, this is our first step towards equality for everyone, you know, because once we get the, you know, the cis homos out of the way, then, you know, we'll be able to work on trans issues and XYZ. Like, this is kind of a brick to a path.
Maybe we do need more spaces for intergenerational connection, like, just for building understanding and empathy between people, and not just intergenerational, but so more intersectional, storytelling and history making.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, obviously the great thing about language is that it evolves all the time. Like you said, and identifying those gaps and then, you know, making a stopgap and that, like, evolving from there.
I would absolutely say that it's better than when I was a kid. And I don't know how much of that is just not being around queer people quite so much, or not being around out queer people quite so much when I was younger. But I don't know, the world seems a lot brighter now.
Humans don't do change well. Humans hate change and they hate the grey areas. That's why, you know, humans are naturally kind of suspicious of bisexuality or polyamory. You know, if someone was assigned male at birth and then transitioned, everyone's like, okay, well, when are you getting the operation? You know, when are you finishing that? Humans hate grey and they hate change. And all we need right now is to recognise the change and the grey, that language is going to evolve. There's no such thing as the good old days. This is the best time to live, because every time before this in modern history was shit for someone. And so we're moving towards equality, towards happiness for everyone. And that only comes with patience, which is the hardest thing in the world to do.
When I was in the process of coming out, I took ownership of the word queer, and that word helped me to understand myself. In turn, it felt like I understood more about the word. Queer, girlfriend, gay, and all those individual words I use to describe my experience, they're my words, but they don't belong to me. A lot happens between saying a word and someone else hearing it, and that's something you can't control. So what does it mean to take a word, with all its connotations, the way it sounds, the way it feels, and make it yours? If you're using a word to describe your experience, and someone else uses that same word, it's easy to assume that you're talking about the same thing. As I chatted to more and more people and learned about their identities, I started to feel a bit awkward when I used the word queer. It was new to me, but it has so much history and shared understanding. It felt like I was taking home a piece of secondhand furniture, wondering how it got its little bumps and scratches, who had used it before, and where it came from. I dusted it off, repurposed it, and it took on its own place in my life. Even though it feels comfortable, and it's loaded with so much personal meaning, there's space for everyone. Now, when I talk about my identity, I want to try to acknowledge all of these different points of view, but it's hard to find the words.
That story was produced by Angela Glinderman, with help from supervising producer Beck Fari. Sound design by Lee Yi and Amy Hanley. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present, and future. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Selena Shannon. Our Victorian State Coordinator is Beck Fari. Our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Jordan Fennell's our SYN Production Manager. Tegan Nichols compiles the show. And I'm Samantha Groth, your host. Shining Bird composed our theme music and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter, and every single one of our previous episodes is patiently waiting for you at allthebestradio.com. Don't forget to subscribe to All the Best on your favourite podcast app.